It is, in a sense, a series which is very much been determined by the wish on our part to produce a series of lectures that will allow you to trace and put together the mark that architects from the past have made upon London in particular. And in this regard, we will be studying during the course of this series Inigo Jones, who we have today, Christopher Wren next week, Robert Adam, John Nash, and then we get to two Royal Academicians, Charles Barry and Sir George Gilbert Scott. Just feel I have to underscore the fact that we do get two academicians in there. And they get more as you get on, of course. Secondly, we felt very strongly that we wanted to launch a series of architectural history lectures. This has not been done before, as I said, but certainly something that we had thought about on several occasions, but had felt somewhat nervous that we might not get an audience. I think this is proof that we had got that. We were completely on the wrong tracks, and I'll let Maxwell Hutchinson talk a little bit more about that in a moment. Thirdly, there is the format. There is going to be initially a presentation about the architect, Inigo Jones, which will set his work within the context of his life and achievement. But then we open up the lecture to a discussion between the speaker, in this case Charles Hind, and the interlocutor, if I may say, which is Maxwell Hutchinson. And this is really a chance to put the architect perhaps into a broader, perhaps a little more of a personal context, dependent upon how the discussion goes. And fourthly, and equally importantly, now the chairman of all of these lectures will be Maxwell Hutchinson, past president of the RIBA, architect in his own right, and also, amongst other things, a major mover in disseminating information, knowledge, and enthusiasm for architecture, both past and present. He himself is going to do a brief resume of the background to the way in which these lectures came into being, and I will pass to him on that matter in a moment. To Maxwell Hutchinson, I'd like to say a brief word about the speaker this evening, Charles Hind. Charles Hind has been, since 1996, the curator of drawings, and now the H.J. Heinz curator of drawings at the Royal Institute of British Architects. From my perspective, Charles has played a very important role in helping to facilitate the move of the RIBA drawings collection from their very cramped quarters in Portman Square to their current location in much more, I think, palatial accommodation within the Victoria and Albert Museum, where, apart from providing excellent facilities for the study of what is a very, very important, indeed internationally, great significance collection of architectural drawings, he also has acquired a gallery which is specifically devoted to the display of architecture. So without more ado, I'm going to pass straight on to Maxwell Hutchinson.
Well, good evening. How nice to see you all. Thank you all for coming. And I'm deeply upset that there are so many people standing outside that aren't able to get in. But it is with considerable gratitude that I thank those of you who are here and for all the efforts you've made to get here. I'm a practicing architect and a television presenter. And I write some books occasionally. And I play the jazz piano not too badly. And I'm quite a good blues guitarist. And just on the side, I happen to have learned a bit about architectural history over the years because I did it by accident, really. I never thought about myself as being engaged in architectural history at all. Until the BBC in London, on BBC London 94.9 FM, please write that down, asked me to do a weekly programme about London's architecture. 16 years ago, I started doing it. The first building I ever talked about was Battersea Power Station, when that was in the news. And I do an hour on Tuesdays on that frequency, which, as you all know by now, is 94.9 FM. Thank you very much. Please don't forget it. So doing architecture twice a week on the radio has made me sort of turn into a sort of architectural historian, Monke. And I'm rather enjoying it. I've actually learned quite a lot about architecture, and I've written books about architecture. But I don't know as much as the experts. But the one thing I do know, above and beyond any form of contradiction by anybody, is that the huge groundswell of enthusiasm for the history of architecture and the desire to know and understand the environment around us in London is without limit. I get into almost every black taxi in London, and when they hear my voice, they say, "You're that geezer on the radio that talks about buildings. What do you think about?" What we have to do, and what this series of lectures is going to do, is to tap into that native enthusiasm for London's buildings. This volumes, this encyclopedia of history and society and wealth and politics and enthusiasm that goes into making our cities. And tonight we start with really the first British architect, the first English architect, whose name anybody can remember unless you're terribly esoteric about your architecture, Inigo Jones. Now, you know there aren't many buildings. I'm not going to ask you now if you can name his buildings, although I guess most of you probably could. But Charles is going to tell you things that you didn't know about him and things that you didn't know about his buildings. As part of this tapestry and part of this wonderful backdrop to our daily lives. Charles Hyde.
Well, thank you, Mary-Anne. Thank you, Maxwell. Given that this series looks at key figures whose buildings contribute to the London we see today, Inigo Jones might not seem, at first, to be the most obvious choice with whom to begin. Certainly, as Maxwell said, he is probably the first architect that most people can name. But beyond that, there's a yawning blank. In London, there are only four surviving buildings by him: the Banqueting House in Whitehall, 1619 to 22, which was about the time that he drew the self-portrait with which I started. Then there's the Queen's Chapel at St. James's Palace, 1623 to 25, the Queen's House at Greenwich, 1630 to 35, and, though much altered, the exterior of St. Paul's Church, Covent Garden, 1631 to 33. Important and interesting though these may seem to the layman, surely there must be something more. Why exactly should Jones be of interest to anyone who wants to know more about the architectural history of London? Well, in this introduction, I'll suggest, and in the conversation later with Maxwell I hope to develop, why Jones's influence, though often subterranean, has had a profound influence on London. As an architect, Inigo Jones is so well known that you might be surprised to hear me describe him as a man of mystery. We know little of him as a person. In modern times, only one proper modern biography of him has been published by Sir John Summerson as long ago as 1966. There's only been one major exhibition of his architectural drawings, and that was in New York and here in the Royal Academy in 1989. Only his work as a stage designer has been thoroughly covered in a book and two major exhibitions, but that was in the late 1960s and early 1970s. All in all, this is a thin crop for a man described by my distinguished predecessor as curator of the drawings collection, John Harris, as unique in his time, a giant in all things, and possessed of an intellect rare even in continental Europe. And again, perhaps the single most important person in the history of the arts in 17th century England. Things might begin to change from March when Yale University Press publishes a new biography of Jones by the late and much lamented Giles Worsley, who died last year. It's he who ought to be engaged this evening in conversation about Jones, and if I achieve anything in the next 20 minutes or so, I hope it'll be to encourage you to read Giles's book. It's a bit of a problem assessing an architect when only 8 out of 46 of his recorded works survive, two of which are church monuments. And of his architectural drawings, only 93 authenticated examples are presently known. But in this introduction, let me talk about Jones in four sections: some biographical information, his work as a stage designer, his career as surveyor of the King's works, and his influence on London architecture. First, some biographical details. Jones was born in London in 1573, the son of a London cloth worker of Welsh extraction. His father was also called Inigo, a name whose origin is unknown and which is otherwise quite unrecorded. The son sometimes Latinized it to Ignatius. Little is known about his early life, but Christopher Wren had information that he was apprenticed as a joiner in St. Paul's Churchyard. However, the first time he actually appears in the records, it's as a picture maker, that is, a painter, not a household decorator, in the household accounts of the first Earl of Rutland for 1603. In that year, Jones accompanied the Earl on a diplomatic mission to Denmark, and there's some evidence that he might already have been in Italy with the Earl's brother in the preceding 3 or 4 years. Back in England, he began working for James I's Queen, Anne of Denmark, designing masks. And this is one of the costumes for the Queen's first mask, the Mask of Blackness, performed at Whitehall on the 6th of January 1605. Costumes and sets by Jones and the text by Ben Jonson. Over the next few years, he seems to have dabbled in architectural design, though he built little, but developed a reputation for being knowledgeable about architecture. He may have paid a second visit to Italy in 1606 and was already gathering illustrated Italian and French books to provide sources for his stage designs. In 1609, he went to Paris bearing diplomatic letters for James I and went on to visit Chambord, Bordeaux and the antiquities of Provence. He was already highly regarded at court, not bad for the son of a cloth worker in the city, for that he's trusted enough to carry out minor diplomatic functions for the court. Architecturally, Jones's career took off following an extended visit abroad, 1613 to 14, in the train of Thomas Howard, Earl of Arundel, he of the marbles. Arundel accompanied James I's daughter, Princess Elizabeth, to Heidelberg, following her marriage to the Elector Palatine. And then he turned south for an extended tour of nearly 18 months. Arundel and his entourage visited Venice, Padua, Vicenza, Florence, Siena, Rome, and Naples, looking at buildings and art collections. Jones took the opportunity to examine Roman ruins as well as modern buildings, but particularly he examined buildings by Palladio and his pupil Vincenzo Scamozzi, buying many drawings by both of them. And this is one of the drawings he bought now in the RIBA collections, a drawing for the Palazzo Porta Festa by Palladio and Vicenza. It's an exterior and an interior view, interior of the courtyard, shown on the same sheet. During this time, he acquired a critical knowledge of the theory and grammar of classical architecture. All this he turned to good use soon after his return to London, when he succeeded in 1615 to the surveyorship of the King's works. Although there was a huge amount of routine administration, the surveyor was responsible for new royal buildings, and James I was a far more lavish patron than Elizabeth I had been. Jones transformed the collegial atmosphere of shared responsibility within the King's works and almost immediately emerged as the dominant personality. Indeed, it was his use of the surveyorship that gave him the position of power in which he dominated English contemporary architecture and indeed British architecture to varying degrees for the next two centuries. He was a valued member of the court, and it's not surprising he was painted by Van Dyck. Until the outbreak of the Civil War in 1641, Jones designed a string of remarkable buildings and advised other designers on quite a few more. This is one of the reasons that he acquired a host of misattributions that modern scholarship is still trying to sort out. During the Civil War, Jones did some work on royalist fortifications, but he was ousted from the surveyorship in 1643 and retired into private life. He died unmarried, but fairly wealthy, in 1652 and was buried in St. Bennet's Church, Paul's Wharf, where his tomb was destroyed in the Great Fire. Jones's first mask was probably for Christian IV, brother-in-law of King James I, during the Danish visit of 1604. At his return to England, he designed more masks for Christian's sister, Anne of Denmark. This is a costume for the Lord's Mask, performed at Whitehall on the 14th of February 1613 on St. Valentine's Day to celebrate the marriage of the Princess Elizabeth to Frederick, Elector Palatine. Costumes and sets by Jones, the text this time by Thomas Campion. These masks weren't cheap, by the way. This one costs some £1,500. £1,500 for a single evening's event. Queen Elizabeth I, by comparison, spent £4,000 a year on her entire building and building administration. Between 1605 and 1640, Jones was responsible for over 50 masks, plays, and staged entertainments at court, often in collaboration with Jonson, until after years of bickering, they parted in 1631 over jealousy of their respective roles. Jonson lampooned Jones several times in his later works for example, as Colonel Iniquo Vitruvius in Love's Welcome at Bolsover of 1634. Architecture often featured in set designs, although it was not of a substantial character, and many elements were derived from foreign books or Jones's observations of performances in Florence at the court of the Medici. His later masque designs, of which this is one, were informed by his architectural development, and this is a design called Cupid's Palace, dating from the early 1620s, and it shows his maturing style. So let's move on to his career as an architect. One of his earliest designs appears to be this proposal of about 1608 for a new terminal to the crossing tower of St. Paul's Cathedral. This is Old St. Paul's, which had been shorn of its spire since 1561. It sits rather awkwardly on the medieval tower, but already it indicates how widely Jones would in due course fling his net in looking at ancient and modern buildings for inspiration. Although the arcade is a paraphrase of the upper section of Palladio's Basilica in Vicenza, Jones did not, as most people assume today, derive here and in his other designs most of his inspiration from Palladio. The pinnacles and spire come from Antonio Labacco's illustration of Antonio da San Gallo the Younger's 1530s designs for St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, while the lunettes on the OG-shaped dome are like those on Michelangelo's dome for the same building. A design by Jones for the New Exchange in the Strand of a few months earlier than this draws on the work of Sebastiano Serlio, published his Architettura, published in 1566. Serlio was the Italian architect and theorist whose works Jones found a useful source. Jones was also aware of developments in France, and many of his chimney piece designs of the late 1620s and early 1630s are derived from or show the influence of French designers such as Jean Barbet in his Livre d'architecture d'hôtel et de cheminée. The banqueting house was the third on the site, its two timber-built predecessors having burned down. Masques were usually lit by torches, so fire was an endemic threat. Rather curiously, since the main room is on the first floor, it's never had an imposing staircase to give access to it. In James's day, the stairs were in a temporary external lean-to. Subsequent proposals to rebuild the whole of Whitehall Palace would have given the building a more coherent setting, and it's unclear if this is what Jones was hoping for as early as 1619, when the building was begun. The Banqueting House is London's first Palladian building. Several drawings exist showing the evolution of the design, variously incorporating ideas from Scamozzi's Palazzo Trissino in Vicenza and designs for palaces taken from Palladio's Quattro Libri dell'Architettura. But the final result, although there are precedents for almost all the individual elements, is uniquely Jones's. In particular, by suppressing early thoughts for a central pediment, which would have crossed the central three bays, and by relying on the pillars alone to the columns to provide a central emphasis, Jones went for a balance and a repose in the whole facade that is not Italian and might therefore be described as English. Originally, the exterior was polychrome, with a brown ironstone basement, a pale yellow Kettenstone walls, and Portland stone, white Portland stone details. So this area would have been a sort of a dark brown, the walls yellow, pale yellow, and then white details over the top. The basement was refaced in Portland stone as early as 1774, but decay continued and the whole building was refaced in new Portland stone in 1829 by Sir John Soane, and that's the building facade that you see today. Inside the building, Jones's great room similarly went through several stages of design, and it's less easy to identify his sources. It may be simply a pragmatic solution, for James I had objected to the pillars supporting the gallery in the previous banqueting house on the grounds they blocked the view. The compartmented ceiling is undoubtedly of Palladian derivation and is of a style used in several buildings by Palladio, such as the Palazzo Barbaran in Vicenza and the Villa Amo. Jones's next surviving project was the Queen's Chapel at St. James's Palace of 1623 to 5. The facade of this derives from designs that Jones had made a few years earlier for the Prince's lodgings at Newmarket. This is a lost building, demolished under the Commonwealth in the 1650s. And this design itself was inspired by a plate in Scamozzi's book on architecture, published in 1615. And you can see that if you take the central section, it's been simplified for use on a much smaller building. Of all Jones's work, the Queen's Chapel is the least altered. It was begun in anticipation of the Prince of Wales marrying the Spanish Infanta, but by the time it was completed, Charles was married to the daughter of the King of France. It didn't matter, both of them were Catholic. Inside, the fittings date from 1682, but the ceiling and the cornice are original. Jones adapted Palladio's woodcuts of the Temple of Venus in Rome in the Roman Forum. The Queen's House has had a checkered history. Originally begun for Anne of Denmark in 1616, it was discontinued at her death in 1619. What had been built was then replaced by a new and larger building from 1630 for Henrietta Maria. By this time, Jones was far less dependent on finding sources in the books of Palladio, Scamozzi, and others, or his trove of their drawings. He was moving towards a much more severe type of elevation, with simply framed windows, with mullions and transoms in those days, not sashes, isolated in broad stretches of plain and unarticulated wall surface. It is late Jones that is most enthusiastically taken up by the Neo-Palladians of the 18th century and the myriad of country builders with their pattern books in hand. The interiors were never completed, and it's unclear if Henrietta Maria actually occupied the building before the Civil War. There do exist a number of unexecuted designs for chimney pieces by Jones that show his awareness of contemporary French design, perhaps reflecting the taste of the Queen, perhaps his own, we shall never know. The interior of the house as presently displayed, by the way, is completely inauthentic, so you should try and avoid looking at any of the soft furnishings, electric light fittings, or other various hideousnesses of the 1990s. No designs at all survive for Covent Garden, begun in 1631. This was a commercial development for the Earl of Bedford, who was keen to develop land to the north of his house, which fronted onto the Strand. Bedford had to pay handsomely for permission to build, no less than £2,000, and an unwritten condition was that the King's surveyor had to be involved. Bedford was shrewd enough to see that the scheme would not work without a church, which meant that he could create a new quarter with a proper symbol of social acceptability. Jones was responsible for the church and devised in outline the rest of the development, which was actually built by Isaac de Coe, a French designer who became naturalised English in 1634. The houses were progressively demolished from about 1880, and the last 17th century part went apparently without comment in 1928, and they occupied the site now occupied by the Opera House extensions. These houses set the pattern for the plan of most terraced houses in London since, with a front and back room, a staircase to one side, and still more importantly, they were the first houses built in England with mews giving on to a back street, that's Floral Street. The facades of the 1880s blocks that you've just seen are rather larger, taller, and grander than the original facades, but in the original facades, the implied order that's shown here are simply pilaster strips. There's no base or capital of any sort on them. It's really stripped classicism, extraordinarily early, something that even Soane might have thought of doing. Jones derived the idea for the layout from Livorno, where Ferdinando de' Medici, Grand Duke of Tuscany, laid out a new cathedral and piazza in the 1590s. Not only had Jones seen this on his first Italian visit, but he would also have known the Parisian derivative, the Place des Vosges, laid out by King Henry IV. One could also point out that the projectors of these two schemes were respectively Queen Henrietta Maria's father and grandfather. The church, according to the apocryphal story, the handsomest barn in England, is a remarkable exercise in the Tuscan order, probably the first church built anywhere to use the style. The portico is derived from the type much used by Palladio, as for example at the Villa Rotonda outside Vicenza. Palladio's sources, illustrated in the Quattro Libri, was the portico of Octavia, while Jones must have seen the original building in one of his Roman visits, as well as seeing the Palladian derivatives. Amongst the greatest losses of Jones's work must be his refacing at Old St. Paul's. As I've mentioned, he was having thoughts about the venerable building as early as 1608, but it was not until William Lord became Bishop of London in 1628 and Archbishop of Canterbury in 1633 that serious work began. The tower had lost its spire due to lightning in 1561, and the external fabric was in a poor state. Perhaps surprisingly, the Gothic choir was carefully repaired, and Jones only completely rethought the facing of the Romanesque transepts and nave, which you see here. In 10 years, he gave the building classical windows, changed the buttresses to pilasters, and crowned the eaves with a heavy block cornice. The pilasters, the cornice, and on the top, large stone pineapples. His main inspiration was the architecture of ancient Rome, which he knew not only from first-hand experience, but from the drawings by Palladio that he had bought in Venice, been given in Venice in 1614. The rustication on the exterior comes from partly from Palladio's reconstruction of the Pantheon, which of course has lost its Roman facing, but also the baths of Diocletian. The giant west portico that you see here is based on the Temple of Venus and Rome, with details from the Temple of Antoninus and Faustina, both in Rome. It was a remarkable effort, for there was no other portico of its dimensions north of the Alps, and it lasted quite intact for only a year or two. Completed just as the Civil War broke out, it was soon defaced. Repairs were underway in 1666, and though Wren tried to save it, it was too badly damaged by the fire and was demolished in 1687. I'll conclude with some thoughts on Jones's influence in the 60 years after his death and before his rehabilitation, in inverted commas, by the Palladian revivalists of the 18th century. There was far more Jones seeping into the work of Wren and his contemporaries than the Palladians thought when they damned the whole Baroque school. A few examples. Although built for Roman Catholic worship, Jones's Queen's Chapel, this is an 18th century section of it drawn by Henry Flitcroft, the chapel provided a formula for Protestant preaching boxes that was widely imitated by Wren and a host of others in Britain and the colonies in the 18th century. A rectangular nave with a Venetian window at one end and a west gallery at the other was simple and endlessly adaptable. The simple arched windows and the frequent use of round windows like portholes over doors that appear in so many Wren churches are also derived from Jones. They must come from his refacing of St. Paul's Cathedral and the church at Covent Garden of about the same time. This is the west end of it. The cherubs acting as a keystone under an entablature, as seen here at All Hallows Lombard Street, must also be a Jones derivative, since they feature so prominently round Old St. Paul's. Jones was so busy as a surveyor that he had little time or opportunity for private work. Developments in London housing, therefore, were really in the hands of others. But until the Civil War brought a halt, his influence was beginning to be felt. This house of circa 1617 is one of the few houses known to have been designed by Jones for Sir Fulk Greville in Holborn. The detailing derives from Palladio, and the house must have been the root source for the house in Lincoln's Inn Fields, probably by Nicholas Stone, and dating from 1638 to 40. This is a rare survival of a type in London otherwise only known from old prints and watercolours. It's the ancestor of innumerable houses in, quotes, Georgian style, all over the country, including its own next-door neighbour. Outside London, the so-called Restoration House, exemplified here by Belton, is usually given a Dutch derivation, but it's more likely a descendant of Jones's Prince's Lodgings at Newmarket that I showed earlier. Compared to Christopher Wren, Jones's reputation has been somewhat eclipsed. Earlier I mentioned the thinness of the literature on Jones, yet books on Wren still come out practically annually. To Lord Burlington and his followers, Jones was as revered a master as Palladio, and appropriate enough, full-length statues of both by Ruysbroeck welcomed visitors to Burlington's villa at Chiswick. This, by the way, is Charles Robert Cockerell's tribute to Sir Christopher Wren, which was exhibited at the Royal Academy in 1838 and heralds the beginning of the Wren Revival, which sees Wren and Wren derivatives becoming practically the national style by the late 19th century, which the RIBA was able to buy last November. William Kent painted an apotheosis of Inigo Jones that, mostly unnoticed today, looks down on visitors climbing the main stairs at Burlington House across the courtyard. But Jones's influence, even on Wren, was considerable, and the Palladians did Wren an injustice in rubbishing him so wholeheartedly. Perhaps, in the process, their own enthusiasm for Jones did him no favours in the 19th century, when Wren's so-called Englishness made him a national hero, and Jones was damned for being too Italian and foreign. Poor old Jones. Let's give him a chance.
Well, thank you so much. It's just a shame we got so few buildings. Why did he waste all his time on this stage set mask business? What was all that about? What is a mask?
Well, a mask is a very elaborate entertainment, usually, well, always really, with allegorical significance, employing various members of the court, including the occasionally the king and queen, which was all part of the public, despite the fact that it was a private entertainment for members of the court, it was all part of the public face of an absolute monarch.
Was it worthy of him, a man of this talent, to spend his time doing pantomimes for the king, so they could all get dressed up and camp about a lot?
Well, I think that's not quite the right way of looking at it.
Well, you described it that way, didn't you, really, when you talked about the costumes?
No, I think that Jones did have a strong view of the importance of the monarchy as the symbol of the state. And I don't think that he regarded masks as time wasted, although he certainly recognized that what was significant about them was their visual appearance rather than the literary content.
So he did it more for doing the drawings and getting the sets done and so on, really, than what was happening in them?
Yes.
So the content was fairly thin, but the drawings were good?
Well, Ben Jonson would have disagreed.
They did disagree horribly, didn't they? They got on very badly.
Yes. I mean, Jonson first collaborated with Jones in 1605 with Anne of Denmark's first mask, and they managed to work together until 1631, when Jonson's bile overflowed and he became impossible to work with. I have to say, I don't think that Jones was necessarily the easiest person to work with, but anyway, with the two characters it was impossible. Jones, I've got a quote here, the one I prepared earlier. In 1631, Jonson said, "All representations, especially of this nature in court, public spectacles, either have been or ought to be the mirrors of man's life." So he saw it as having a sort of profound philosophical basis. Jones responded in 1632, "These shows are nothing else but pictures with light and motion."
Ah, he's on my side then about
He's on your side, yes, to some extent. Jonson then sort of lampooned Jones as often as possible, and in fact Charles I had to intervene to tone down some of the published versions. I mean, Jones basically shot himself in the foot because it more or less put an end to his career at a court. I think he ought to be, as the other writers were, they just sort of got on with the job.
What I don't understand is where this man who was born in Smithfields, and a cloth worker, and maybe worked as a carpenter, how did he get the courage and insight to absorb this continental Renaissance architecture and completely change the nature of the way the British saw the way in which they should design buildings? How did it happen? What caused this surge of enthusiasm and inventiveness in this young man?
Well, boundless self-confidence, I suppose, was the first.
Born out of what?
Well, that's what's so difficult to know, because the personal details of Jones's life are incredibly scanty. We either have the opinion of John Webb, who was his sort of nephew by marriage. He referred to Jones as his uncle, and Webb was his pupil and amanuensis. And his career went on until after the Restoration, and he felt it necessary to end Jones's reputation. So he was always saying how wonderful Jones was. On the other hand, there were those considerable numbers of people who actually disliked Jones intensely. Johnson wasn't the only one, and who refer to his sort of pride and his overbearing
endemic
nature.
Architectural characteristics, isn't it, really?
Well, as an employee of the RIBA, I couldn't possibly comment.
I think you have to be quite arrogant and forthright to be able to do the sorts of things that he did.
Oh, yes, I think Jones wouldn't have been Jones and wouldn't have had the effect on architecture that he did if he hadn't been absolutely sure that what he was doing was right.
But it's difficult for us now to picture the buildings that we are also accustomed to. We go past the banqueting house in Whitehall, and it seems an intrinsic part of the backdrop to everyday life in London. But when he wrought this building and dropped this building into the heart of London, it must have been devastatingly different and shocking.
Well, if you think of pre-fire London as being largely timber-built, I mean, even the grandest people in the city of London were content to live in timber-framed buildings. There's a famous house that belonged to Sir Paul Pindar. Pindar, incredibly wealthy merchant who contributed a huge amount of money to the rebuilding of, fitting of Old St. Paul's. He paid for the fittings in the chancel, in the choir, and contributed generally to the building fund. And was one of the wealthiest men in the city. And he lived in a narrow, timber-fronted house in Bishopsgate that projected over the street, and the part of the facade is now in the B&A. But it's a modest house. Jones's type of architecture really must have been revolutionary to people who'd never travelled abroad. Stone building was very expensive. The building regulations that came into force after the Great Fire, as an obvious response to the problem of a timber-built city, weren't there. There were regulations about building, but not specifying no timber building. And to see these great buildings going up, I mean, the Queen's House was and the Queen's Chapel, both contrasted vividly with the red brick, low Tudor palaces to which they were then attached. Yes, it was revolutionary stuff. It must have been as shocking to Londoners as Goldfinger's house was in Willow Road to the staid inhabitants of Hampstead in 1930s.
I think a bit more than that. I mean, Goldfinger's house is actually quite modest, isn't it, now? Surely the Lloyd's building is a better model of something utterly shocking, utterly different.
This is funny, even that looks passé these days, doesn't it? Yes, yeah, you're probably right.
Well, don't start me on that one. But let's just talk a little bit about Palladio and why Palladio and what was the significance in choosing him as the model. Was it just convenience because it was northern Italy so he didn't have to go too far south?
No, Palladio.
You know, I really thought I'd crack that one.
No, it's a nice theory. No, Palladio's great contribution to world architecture was his book, his Quattro Libri.
His four books.
His four books, of which He projected 8, but 4 were published and as a single volume in 1570. Other architects had published, such as Sebastiano Serlio. There were theorists who had also published,
Alberti
and so on. There were illustrated editions of Vitruvius. But the approach that Palladio took was essentially that of a practical man, a pragmatic stonemason who turned to design and who studied Roman architecture, looked for sources, but basically created a program of classical architecture which could be adapted for contemporary use. And he thought through the whole thing far more than the English social situation.
So he invented British classicism?
Yes, he's the first person who really thinks classicism through from beginning, whereas his contemporaries and the immediately preceding generations had taken classical ornament, which they'd sort of seen in books published in the Netherlands and also in Italy, and just sort of stuck bits on. I mean, you can think of classicism as basically a sort of MFI sort of classicism, if you like. They would take things, they wouldn't understand what they were really for, but they would just sort of stick them on regardless.
Applique.
Applique. And essentially they were sticking them on traditional, slowly evolving, but traditional English buildings. And Jones was actually rethinking the whole idea of what these buildings were for. And he adapted the villa architecture for use in towns. I mean, you might be slightly surprised, but one could argue that the banqueting house, for example, does draw on villa elements in Palladio, despite the fact that it's behind that facade, you've just got one big room over a basement. And so he thinks classicism back to its beginnings, but he recognizes that Palladio is useful, more useful than many, but he also draws on people like Scamozzi and the other people I mentioned in the preliminary talk.
How was he seen at the time? How was his building seen and appreciated? Were they understood? Or were they thought as being slightly lunatic fringe and continental?
Well, there's not a huge amount of documentation, unfortunately, of people sort of sitting down, you know, dear diary, I've just been to,
yeah,
and I think
said,
it's absolutely ghastly.
You said he was an enigma at the beginning of what you had to say.
I think that historians have tended to pigeonhole Jones as a court architect, and therefore, if he's a court architect, he must be a royalist architect, and therefore, anybody who isn't a royalist who does classical architecture must be anti-Jones, and sort of look at the other types of classical architecture that developed from the 1620s. I think which that tends to underplay, which is something I was trying to refer to at the end, that tends to underplay Jones's influence on the wider building world.
Well, this series is called The Architects Who Made London, and if you look at the fact that we've only got a few buildings to his left, he wouldn't be included if it wasn't for his influence later on in the development of London, would it really? If we misjudged him by the buildings that we find.
Yes, but I think that he was behind the first square built in London.
Mm. Most of which isn't there.
Well, the original.
The former square is there, but the buildings aren't there.
But they say this is where I mentioned at the beginning that his influence on London is now, well, subterranean is not quite the right word, because he's actually most of the evidence of his own time has been knocked down. But he's behind that square. He's behind the terraced house, which, you know, how many millions of terraced houses are there in London still being built to a Jonesian plan?
Now, not diminishing his significance, I'm just saying this is why we think he is significant, not because of what's left in his buildings, but of the influence that he had. Looking at St. Paul's Covent Garden, for example, you pointed out to me earlier that the fact that it doesn't face onto the square, it has a blank facade onto the square, but originally had two doors on either side of the high altar, and it faces the way, it appears the way it does onto the square because it's east-facing. And, of course, the west front was never brickwork originally either, you told me earlier. It was stucco.
Yes, the Church of Covent Garden, if you go inside, don't expect a Jonesian interior because the church burnt down in 1795. And it was rebuilt as a perfectly nice but sort of Georgian preaching box. The exterior of the building in Jones's day was stucco. lined out to look like stone, and only the portico and details around the doors and windows were stone. After the fire, it was restored as Portland stone, and then the Victorians didn't like that. I suspect in a curious or inverted way, given that the red brick with stone dressings that one associates with Wren was turned on its head, and the Victorians didn't like the stone, so they actually thought a Wrenian effect would actually be rather nice, which is when they refaced it in that rather odd red-coloured brick.
Which is part of a very big lesson in the way in which you read London's buildings, because so often what you see now is actually nothing like what was there before at all. And we can make value judgments about how appropriate they are for their settings today without understanding this complex generative process that has made them what they are. I mean, the Queen's House, for example, it was actually spanned the main Dover Road at one time, didn't it, with a bridge over the two halves. It was an H plan. Hmm. What a bizarre... Why put it over a road? When you've got all that space at Greenwich.
Well, that was a rather practical solution to enable the court to get from the Palace of Greenwich and its immediate surroundings over the public road to the park, originally a hunting park, beyond. And in Tudor times, there was a gatehouse that spanned on the same site as the Queen's House, that spanned the road and enabled members of the court to get from one side to the other, effectively over a bridge. Now, the Queen's House was built for the same purpose. And if you can remember your north and south fronts, the side that faces the river is a plain wall with window openings. The side that faces up the hill towards the Greenwich Observatory is the one that's got the portico where the ladies of the court could sit and watch what was going on in the park, the hunting or whatever, without muddying their feet with the proles who were sort of wheeling their carts underneath the house.
Coming, so right the way through the Queen's House, there's the major Dover Road going. But the one bridge is now free, is that right?
Yes, after the Civil War, or after the Restoration, two extra bridges were added, which makes the house look a complete rectangle.
When the Rubens ceiling went up in the banqueting house, did they stop having masks there? Because you told us that they were lit rather extravagantly and lots of smoke. What did they do then when this precious ceiling went up?
Well, this is why one wonders whether Jones was looking forward to the chance to build a new Whitehall Palace, because before the banqueting house was finished, the Rubens ceiling was commissioned. The building began in 1619. I think the ceiling was commissioned in 1621, but it wasn't actually installed until the early 1630s. Once it had been installed, of course, Jones then had to build another banqueting house next door for the masks to move into, leaving the present banqueting house as essentially a throne room, which, of course...
Which is the way it looks today.
Which is the way it looks today and the way it's treated. As originally built, the one thing that has changed on the inside is that, as originally built, behind the throne was a great apse, which would have given an even more remarkable effect with the king sitting on his throne in this great apse. But about 1625, for reasons that we don't know, I mean, the accounts record that it happened, but the reasoning isn't given, the apse was removed and it was given a flat west wall.
The Queen's Chapel at St. James's Palace, although it is the Queen's Chapel, it's where the Queen often worships, because it is part of the Church of England, it's open to the public. If you would care to go there for morning or evening prayer or the Eucharist on some Sundays, you can go in and see those interiors that I've been privileged. All of these buildings I've filmed, I've been very privileged to film them all. But because it is a public place of worship, you can go. And if you happen to see Her Majesty up on the balcony, you'll be doubly blessed. But you'll certainly be blessed by seeing the interior. One of the controversies about the banqueting house is out of which window did Charles I walk to his execution? One fascinating little aside, if you look at the clock on Horse Guards opposite the banqueting house, around the number 2, there is a black circle because regicide happened at 2 p.m. when the king dressed up mightily because it was very cold. What was the date?
30th
of January. That's a royalist. It's a Jeremy Ryan. So it was jolly cold, but he didn't want to think people that he was shivering out of fear, but out of the cold. So to sum up, Jones, It isn't just because of the buildings, it's because of his influence and his character and his perception, his ability to go abroad to foreign lands and gather about him this new knowledge.
Yes, I think that he opened up what was essentially a provincial architectural scene in terms of Europe, and in its own sphere made it as good as anything that was available in Europe. And then his posthumous influence can be seen all over the world.
So he's definitely one of the architects that made London. I have three thank yous to say. First of all, the fact that the SMC Group PLC, of which I must declare an interest as I'm a non-executive director, has helped to fund this series of lectures, and I'm very grateful to my fellow colleagues on the board to agreeing to do that. Secondly, to the Royal Academy, for having the faith to believe that architectural history could actually make a series work. And third and most important of all, to Charles. If you were looking at the architects that made London, if you looked at the amount of creation that they'd done, you would never think that Inigo Jones was someone that you would naturally pick. Yes, he is the first English architect that you would recognise by name. What Charles has done today is reaffirm in our minds, if we needed it, that Jones is the person that sowed the seeds for the London that we see today. He created the ideas and the context and the creative idealism for the London that we all know and understand today. Charles mentioned the fact that we wouldn't have had the London house with room front, room back, and the staircase to the side without his inventiveness. We probably wouldn't have had many of the Wren churches that were built after the Great Fire of London without the courage that was shown by Inigo Jones in his attitude to rebuilding and remodeling the old St. Paul's. And coincidentally, when you go to the horrible Paternoster Square, there's a rather inexplicable column standing lonely over a ventilator to the car park. That's meant to be emblematic of the colonnade at the west front of St. Paul's built by Wren, despite the fact that you told me that the columns were, 45 feet high or something? They were a grand order. So shame on whoever decided to put that column there, and shame more because there's no explanation of why it's there, apart from trying to disguise a ventilator. Inigo Jones is undoubtedly the person who started to make modern London. And maybe it was unfortunate in some ways that he paved the way for that, for the context of rebuilding London, before the Great Fire happened. Without the coincidence of time and his personality and his inventiveness, it may be that after the Great Fire, people would have been struggling to know what to do. But he pointed the way. After the Great Fire of London, Wren and others who helped to rebuild the city had got the example set out by Jones. He'd done far more than I think he probably imagined during his life, to point in the direction not only of the way the city was built after the Great Fire, but Palladianism and the distinguished attitude that the British had to the Renaissance and the integration of Renaissance architecture into the English scene. Giles, I'm eternally grateful to you. Thank you.